Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to come and talk about what I've been working on. So I'm going to talk about a project that I've been doing with David for the last few months. We've been learning all about stars because we want to understand properly the possible signatures of mirror stars. So this isn't out yet as a paper. We think we're sort of a few more weeks to go on. We think we have a good handle on the results now. But of course, any discussion is welcome and probably helpful at this stage. So first, I'll talk a bit about our motivation, why we're interested in mirror sectors in the first place. And it's kind of our starting point is the mirror twin Higgs model. And I'll talk about mirror stars more generally, talk about, you know, what do I mean by a mirror star? Well, maybe I should explain that now. So a mirror star, we imagine we have some kind of mirror sector, which is similar enough to the standard model that there is some analog of nuclear fusion which can occur in this sector. And if this is true, then maybe we can have star-like objects which undergo mirror nuclear fusion in their cores and emit mostly into mirror photons. So I'll talk a bit about how we might detect such objects if they exist. And one of the key ingredients to this argument is how much interstellar matter, standard model matter, accumulates in the core of these stars. And then we care about the details of what the captured matter looks like once it's captured, so the density profile and temperature profile of the captured matter. These are crucial for us to estimate the signal that we get from these guys. And by signal, I mean amount of standard model photons that these things can emit. If they emit standard model photons, then maybe we have a chance of seeing them.
It works.
Ah, great. I should do away with the hockey stick. So first of all, why do we care about mirror sectors? So the idea of mirror sectors has been around for a while, but maybe there's kind of a renewed interest in mirror sectors now from a sort of naturalness perspective. So one example of a naturalness-inspired model which features a mirror sector is the mirror twin Higgs model. So this is it's a solution to the little hierarchy problem, more accurately. And in this model, we have, along with the standard model fields, we have sort of a copy of the standard model, a mirror sector.
You can switch the slide forward with the doodad.
Oh, right, yeah. Yes. Took a moment for my brain to adjust. Oh, can I, though?
There you go. The battery's not.
Yeah, I have to press it a bit hard. It's fine. Now, some versions of the mirror twin Higgs model really predict a full mirror sector. So by a full mirror sector, I mean that every field in the standard model has some analog in the mirror sector. And this is going to be an approximate copy of the standard model. What do I mean by approximate? Well, for phenomenological reasons, you require the masses of the mirror sector particles to be heavier than their analogs in the standard model sector. The reason for this is that you have a mirror Higgs which mixes with our Higgs. This gives you some branching ratio of the Higgs into stuff that we don't see, and there's collider constraints on these kind of decays. And it turns out that to evade these constraints, it's simply sufficient to raise the mirror twin Higgs VeV by a factor around 3 or more. These models also have a cosmological problem. They generally predict a too large value for this ineffective parameter, which is a cosmological observable, which effectively measures the number of light degrees of freedom in your model. And there's various ways of getting around this. The one we're most interested in is this asymmetric reheating story. The idea here is that you introduce some, for instance, a right-handed neutrino, a heavy right-handed neutrino, which decays preferentially into the standard model rather than the mirror sector, which you kind of get for free because the W boson of the mirror sector is heavier than our W boson, so the decays into the mirror sector are suppressed. And this has the effect of diluting the energy density in the mirror sector, which can suppress the contribution to the delta ineffective. And the reason why we like this is because it really allows us to maintain this sort of full mirror structure. You know, we keep our light quarks, so we can start to ask fun questions like, what is the mirror nuclear physics?
So can I ask you, if you insist like 10% huni, so basically PA over VB of 3.
Right.
So what is the delta ineffective you expect?
So I think for the ineffective, you have to have this fraction has to be 5 rather than 3 or something like that, right?
But like a few. You get roughly that kind of parametric suppression for this particular kind of dilution model.
Yeah, so...
So if you were to limit, so is 10% tuning still okay? Or do you need a few percent tuning?
So I guess the tuning is like VVA over VV squared.
So, right, in these models, right? Because it's like the...
So I guess, you're sort of between 10% and a percent tuning, I guess, is what you need to get around this, so the reason we like this is because it allows you to start playing with like twin nuclear physics. So you can ask questions like, what is the ratio of the mirror proton to the to our proton mass? Well, this, of course, depends on the mirror lambda QCD scale. And this can be calculated in terms of this ratio just from the beta functions. You can also think about what is the binding energy of deuterium. This is comes from like a reinterpretation of lattice results. So this is like the allowed range as a function of this VeV ratio here. So the binding energy lies somewhere in here. And importantly for us, the deuteron remains stable in the mirror sector, which allows us to start thinking about like stellar fusion reactions and things like that. So you can think about the cosmology of these models, and there's lots of interesting stuff there. And go and read David's paper if you're interested in that. The mirror sector can't account for the total dark matter abundance. There's bounds from large-scale structure bounds, self-interaction bounds. At most, the mirror sector can be about 10% of dark matter density, and this constraint will get tighter in the future. And other fun things you can do, you can estimate, like, as a function of some input parameters, what the mass ratio of mirror helium to mirror hydrogen is, and compare this to the standard model, where the mass ratio of helium to hydrogen is 25%. In the mirror sector, you can make a robust prediction that it's around 75%. So you have more mirror helium than the corresponding helium fraction in the standard model. So of course, you know, the reason we care about these kind of considerations is because, you know, in principle, these models are testable at colliders, but we haven't seen anything yet at colliders. And kind of the idea of mutual naturalness models is that they're by construction more difficult to test at the LHC. They evade collider bounds more easily. And so it's important to consider any sort of complementary signals that might exist, so cosmological and or astrophysical signatures.
So why is the helium bigger? I mean, like...
Why is there more helium?
Yeah, like...
So I'm not completely familiar with this calculation, so maybe...
So is like the mirror neutron like lighter than the mirror proton or something?
It comes down to the ratio of like how unstable, how much, if you increase the quark masses, how much more unstable is the mirror neutron compared to how much more stable the mirror deuteron is. And there's a ratio in there that you can take, and that sort of takes you into this regime. So the mirror deuteron is the thing that controls the BBN. Is the thing, you know, when the mirror deuteron bottleneck gets resolved, that's when you make all new helium, and that has to be compared to the mirror. So the temperature of the plasma during when it is similar to the mirror deuteron binding energy has to be compared to the neutron lifetime, the mirror neutron lifetime. So those are things that you can calculate either with this lattice stuff or with this just weak decays, and the sort of mnemonic is the mirror neutron is more stable. The mirror neutron is less stable than ours, but it's more stable compared to how tightly bound the mirror deuteron is. And that just comes from lattice magic, quite frankly. Like, it's an incredibly surprising thing that the mirror deuteron is even stable.
So delta ineffective fixes the temperature, the relative temperature between the two sectors, basically.
Right, I mean, it fixes your... VB over VA to be greater than some...
but it also fixes the temperature between, doesn't it?
So the mirror helium mass fraction is independent, fairly independent of these parameters, essentially.
The thing is that usually one of the other thing is depending on how many degrees of freedom you have and the temperature, there is also the proton to neutron mass ratio, fraction ratio, that also determines the helium.
Oh, yeah. So that is exactly where this pops out of.
Okay.
I mean, also, we're decoupling delta ineffective from VB over VA just to be model independent. But for a particular reheating mechanism, they're coupled together.
Yes, I would imagine,
right? Yeah, okay. So this cosmology is very interesting and good. But so we want to now we move on to sort of rather than cosmological signatures, astrophysical signatures. Like if the nuclear physics really is similar enough to our nuclear physics, maybe mirror stars. Objects which, you know, they collapse out of a cloud of mirror matter and start to burn mirror hydrogen into mirror helium. Maybe objects like this can form. So mirror stars have been discussed quite a bit before by people like Robert Foote and others. And in these cases, they're usually considering an exact mirror sector. So they're considering a mirror sector which is like all the masses and couplings are the same as the standard model. You have some like exact Z2 symmetry between them. But this really been their estimate of like a concrete estimate for like the sort of qualitative discussions about how we might see these things, but no sort of a quantitative, robust estimate of the signal of these things. And so we're not just interested in mirror stars as predicted by the mirror twin Higgs model. We're interested in a broad class of models which feature some analog of our nuclear fusion. And mirror twin Higgs model is a good benchmark for these kind of models, but you also can also have these like exact mirror sectors fall into this class of models as well. So mirror stars could exist. Clearly we haven't seen them yet, and the mirror sector is presumably rather weakly coupled to the standard model. So you might think, how are we ever going to see these things, especially if they're far away? But I think it's important to remember just how easy standard model stars were to discover. We discovered them a very, very long time ago, and inspired by this great success, it's actually maybe not so hopeless an endeavor to look for mirror stars. So how would we go about seeing these things? Well, as usual in any model where you have a second U1 gauge boson, you expect some kind of kinetic mixing between the mirror photon and our photon. In the mirror twin Higgs model, in the models we're considering, the mirror photon will be massless, which means that you have this basis freedom. Essentially, in models with a massless dark photon, you have a continuous series of orthogonal transformations you can do on the photon-mirror photon basis, which retain the canonical kinetic term structure. And one useful basis you can think about is that the mirror matter is millicharged under our photon. And so that's what this plot is showing, is bound on millicharged particles, essentially, which is where our bound on epsilon comes from. So the current bounds for, the bound depends on what the mass of the lightest millicharged particle in the model is, which in our case is the mirror electron. And so we're sitting sort of around here on the plot. And so the most relevant bounds come from the supernova, actually, which gives you an epsilon around 10 to the minus 9. Now, if we're talking about sort of naturalness-inspired models, maybe epsilon of 10 to the minus 9 might seem a bit small, but actually, in the mirror twin Higgs model, epsilon is actually forbidden at 1 and 2 loop by the symmetries in the model, so maybe such a small value is not so unreasonable. So, you have, like I said, you have this basis freedom, and so this is kind of useful to sort of go through in a bit of detail. There's one useful basis in which you can think of the standard model matter as being millicharged under the mirror U1. There's another basis where you can think of the mirror matter as being millicharged under our photon. And so you can sort of think about this a bit and think about, okay, let's say you have some mirror star with some mirror nuclei flying around. And given that these, in this basis, the mirror nuclei are millicharged under our photon, you might wonder, can this mirror matter just emit spontaneously a standard model photon? And if it were to do this, then the standard model photon would not interact strongly with the matter and would just escape the star. And so it kind of looks like maybe if you peer into this star, you can sort of see the core of photons being emitted here. That's not quite correct, because what actually happens is that the mirror matter emits a coherent superposition of this photon and this photon. And if you look in this basis, you can see it more clearly. The mirror matter cannot emit a mirror photon. It emits whatever the combination that's emitted by the mirror matter continues to scatter off the mirror matter and behaves exactly as photons in the sun would behave, for instance. But what you can say is that because our telescopes are effectively millicharged under the mirror U1, what we can see is this epsilon squared times the mirror intensity that the star emits. So if epsilon is 10 to the minus 9, epsilon squared times the luminosity of the sun is very, very small luminosity. So you might think, oh, well, let's just give up there. But actually, the story gets a bit more interesting when you think about the fact that standard model matter will generally accumulate in the star. And standard model matter will interact weakly with the mirror matter in the star, but it will still interact. Yes?
Are you assuming like A prime is as massless?
Yes, I am. Yeah. Okay. I guess in general, you don't have to do that.
No.
But yeah, for...
It's a nice assumption.
Yeah. So... in particular, if there's any, like especially ionized matter building up in the star, it can induce this mirror photon conversion. So this is essentially a Compton scattering. And this is an epsilon squared suppressed process. But in principle, in the presence of, for instance, free electrons, mirror photon can convert into a photon. And so if you have some free electrons, for instance, in the core, And if the captured density is sufficiently low that this captured matter is optically thin, then it would be the case that these photons can just convert and then just leave the star.
Can you have distortions of the CMB because of this?
Because of this kind of process, you mean?
Yeah.
I think there probably are bounds.
Yeah, that's in those plots that there's those CMB bounds.
Right.
Well, that's from an effective.
This would be a different process.
So this would be actual physical dark photons getting converted to dark photons getting converted.
I think I've seen bounds based on that.
Yeah.
I don't think the bounds are relevant for. I think they're not as strong as these supernova bounds, for instance.
Because for example, for axions, they are kind of close. Hmm. So for axion to photon conversion. That's why
right.
I mean, it is similar. It's a dark photon to photon conversion process.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm saying. I don't know.
It's worth looking into. I mean, the reason we were so pleased about this very simple process is that when it comes to mirror stars, they have never been considered before as a signal source.
No, I know. So but I'm asking, is there another place?
For CMB, exactly.
Yes, is there
it's
another?
Mm-hmm. It's worth looking into. Yeah.
The temperature of mirror CMB the same as the.
It's higher, I guess, right?
No, it's
lower.
Colder.
It's colder.
I thought these things, but it's going to be set by your hydrogen atom in the mirror sector, which is higher, isn't it?
No. It's set by the four. I mean, whatever. Sorry, I'm answering you, but no, it's not. Delta ineffective is less than one.
Sorry. Yeah, it's higher when it happens. But then it happened earlier, both because it needed to happen at a higher temperature and because the temperature of the mirror sector is diluted. So both of those things will shift the surface of light scattering further back in time. For the mirror sector.
What's the temperature now for them?
Oh, like, you know, order V over F squared smaller than us,
yeah.
So 0.1 Kelvin or something. So,
I see.
But I guess the question is whether this, so now I'm even more doubtful whether it matters, because if the mirror CMB freezes out, so to speak, at earlier times.
I'm not talking about
the mirror photons.
This would be as a CMB distortion, right? So CMB distortions are, I mean, there's constraints from COBE, there's stuff you can affect. It doesn't matter. They don't have to be in thermal equilibrium. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Does the density ever get on resonance, like between the two sectors?
I don't think so. But actually, you know what? Whatever CMB distortion bounds do exist will depend on the cosmology. So if there's reheating. The mirror photon bath would be sourced by the earlier surface of last scattering for the mirror dark photons. That's actually very interesting to look into. It's actually a very, very good point. Yeah, it's worth looking into.
Yeah.
Since you've been stopped, what's the dark matter in this picture? Are we supposed to think of the cosmological picture on the mirror side as being basically like it is on the regular side, the dark matter is not talking to anybody apart from gravity?
Well, I mean, I guess that depends on what the model that you've... I mean, in principle, the mirror matter, like I said, the mirror matter can't be more than... say 10% of the dark matter. So you could have dark matter which doesn't interact with any of this, or maybe there's some...
Which is a separate knob you get to
die. Yeah, right, yeah. I mean, maybe you could build a model where the dark matter somehow talks to both these sectors in some interesting way.
What you're thinking about is that it's the cosmology on the mirror side is basically paralleling with the cosmology on the ordinary side, too. And both of them are just basically talking to dark matter and gravitational.
Right, in principle, yeah. So because of this potential signal, I mean, and also if you have standard model matter here in the core, it's going to be heated up by collisions with the mirror nuclei, and it will also cool down. And this cooling can also emit standard model photons. So that's kind of a different signal to what I'm talking about here. So generally, to calculate the signal, we want to know, like, what are the properties of like, how much matter did these things capture, and what are the properties? What is the temperature of the captured matter, for instance? Because that will determine, like, how much of it is ionized, which influences... which determines how much of this process can occur. So first I'm going to sort of run through a very, very naive estimate of what the luminosity due to this process would be, just to sort of see how it compares to like this epsilon squared suppression of the mirror luminosity. So this is a bit of a sort of a toy setup here, just to get an estimate. But we can think of a photon in the sun, you can think of it as random walking its way to the surface. And you can estimate like the distance it travels in that random walk, because it goes as r squared, the radius of the star, over lambda mirror, which is like the mean free path of the photon. So your mirror photon travels some characteristic distance. And we want to think about what is the probability that it will convert via this sort of Thompson scattering process before it escapes. So you can define some lambda standard model, which is the mean length to travel before it converts into a standard model photon. And then because it turns out the lambda standard model will be much, much larger than d, so approximately a fraction d of a lambda standard model will convert. And if you make the assumption that the only way that the photons interact with the matter is via this kind of scattering, which isn't true, but it is true at high temperatures and for highly ionized stellar material, then you can relate these two lambdas. They become related to the relative densities of the standard model matter which is captured and the density of the mirror nuclei. And using this sort of this naive estimate, you can estimate the fraction of photons which convert into standard model photons and then escape. So you get this epsilon squared factor here from the cross section for the conversion process. But then you have this sort of order one, dimensionless quantity at the front, which naively you look at it, is this smaller than one, bigger than one? It's not clear without knowing exactly how much matter is captured.
So this is radiation that will be lost in just mirror photons produced.
These
are not things we can.
This is mirror photons.
L mirror. What you mean is when you talk about L mirror, you mean mirror photons, not things that we can see.
Right. L mirror is the total mirror luminosity of the mirror star. The luminosity into mirror photons.
Dark photon. Okay.
Yes, but then this is the fraction which convert into standard model photons. There's an estimate for the fraction which convert into standard model photons, and therefore an estimate for the signal that we can see.
So, but the spectrum of these things, if they get constantly scattered and re-emitted, wouldn't the spectrum be similar to standard model photons? Why should it happen? How would you tell it apart from the ordinary emission of the?
Well, it's right. I mean,
the
but
standard model. You have a star. You have the sun.
There's no star there, right? I mean, it's just like this, like.
Oh, dark. You're right. Sorry. Yes. Sorry. Yes. Oh yeah, I'm an idiot. Yes.
Yeah, so I mean, it's basically, it only has to do this conversion process once before it leaves. So
you're talking about not mirror matter that capturing our stars. It's just
yes.
Mirror
yeah,
stars.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, I may confuse mirror matter and standard model matter at some point. Just ask if it's a bit unclear because it can get a bit confusing. yeah. So the point is that to really estimate this fraction correctly, we want to know the properties of the captured matter. We want to know like how dense it is. And technically, rather than R being the radius of the star, what I really want R to be is like the radius of the captured, because it might be captured, it might be confined within some region, which is a fraction of the radius of the star. And I want to understand the shape of this profile a bit better. So in principle, we could go and like simulate mirror stars as predicted by the mirror twin Higgs model. Like we have the information that we need. In principle, we understand things like the weak interaction is slower in the mirror sector, but deuterium will have a higher binding energy. One can like assume that the mirror helium is 75% of the star, just given by the sort of densities that I talked about earlier. And then you can just go and solve the equations of stellar structure and like have a model of a mirror star. Turns out the most difficult part of this is actually understanding the mirror opacity. So opacity is like describes the interactions between the photons and the stellar material, and there's lots of different processes which contribute to the opacity. One of them is Thompson scattering, which is like depends on how the free electrons that you have, but they also have like bound free transitions. And in principle, this is something we could calculate. All the expressions for these the processes are known, so maybe this is something that we're thinking of doing at some point, is taking the mirror twin Higgs model specifically and ask what mirror stars look like. But as I said earlier, we're interested in really in a broader class of models than just the mirror twin Higgs model. We're interested in any kind of model which can give rise to some kind of analog of our nuclear physics. So this stuff is interesting. It's a project in its own right, but we're interested in a broader class of models. So for now, let's just try and understand the sort of the basics of this signal. And so to simplify what we're doing, we're just going to assume that the mirror stars are standard model-like. Just because we understand standard model stars, we can use like standard model star simulations, and yeah, so we're assuming they have the same opacity, same reaction rates, and then we're just going to take a few benchmark stars, for instance, one solar mass, 10 solar masses, or whatever, and calculate what the signal would be for those stars, assuming they were mirror stars rather than standard model stars.
So, by same opacity, does that mean that the opacity is zero metallicity, or does that mean like the opacity?
Right. Yeah. I mean, opacity depends on the composition. for the stars that we simulated, I think I put it in zero metallicity, but that's okay, something you can just change. So what I've been doing is, because I want to have some profiles of realistic stars to play with, I learned how to use like MESA at the very basic level. So I basically just put in the mirror mass, the mirror star mass. I in FinSquare can adjust to compositions. I just sort of press go, and it basically what it does is it simulates a big cloud of matter which collapses, and then you can see here this shows you like the profile of the star and the density and temperature across the profile, and there you can see the fusion happening there, which is fun. But the end result for me is I have a bunch of profiles for a bunch of different benchmark stars, like temperature profiles. This is for a solar mass star, density profiles, luminosity profiles. And I have all the information for pressure, opacity, composition, and things like that. And so this is what I will use as like an input into our calculation.
How does the, in these curves, how does the standard model look like? Because I have no idea how to read
this. This is basically the sun. Because this
so
is.
It looks exactly the same as the sun?
Pretty
so
much, yeah.
So the fact that you change the masses of the quarks doesn't.
Oh, but we have, that's what I said earlier is that we're not doing that. For now, we're just assuming that these stars are standard model like. Right, yeah. So we didn't. I mean, that's a good point. I mean, we haven't really, like, the point of what we're doing is to do these calculations, we are just using standard model stars. Like, if we cared about specifically the mirror twin Higgs model, then you want to think about, okay, what do they look like if they are made mostly of helium, things like that. But for now, we're just dealing with standard model stars.
I guess the point is that the signal from mirror stars has never been calculated properly. There's been a few sentences in the foot papers, but some of them are incorrect, and it has never been looked at, and it turns out that there are surprises. So the point is, you want to decouple the very interesting problem of figuring out the mirror nuclear physics and the mirror stellar physics from how to compute the signal. So now we're just taking standard model stars and saying that they're mirror stars.
Right, the density profile should be quite different, though, right?
Sure. Absolutely. We're just learning how to compute the signal.
Yeah.
So this is a learning how to compute the signal, and it's going to be the correct result and the exact mirror limit. But presumably what you learn about computing the signal, you can then apply to more diverse classes of mirror stars that you figure out. So that's the approach.
Yeah, right. So yeah, this is basically the sun. Actually, the fun fact is that the sun over its lifetime actually gets slightly bigger and slightly more luminous. So actually the MESA gives me what it looks like just after it's formed, rather than how it looks currently, which is like five billion years later or whatever. But yeah. So we have some benchmark stars with some profiles, and we can go about starting to do this calculation. So we have lots of ingredients to the calculation. We care about how much standard model matter is captured by these things, that we have to take into account in various ways that captured matter can escape. So one way that it can, it can scatter off the mirror nuclei in the star. It can also scatter off the stuff which has already been captured in the star. There's this process which is called evaporation, which can happen if the sort of the thermal velocity of the captured material is not that far below the escape velocity. Some fraction of the matter can just escape from being in the tail of the Boltzmann distribution. So we care also about what temperature the captured matter is. So it can be heated via collisions between the mirror nuclei and the captured nuclei. And it can also cool. There's various processes by which it can cool, for instance, Bremsstrahlung cooling. If there's some fraction of the material is ionized, then the ions can essentially Bremsstrahlung, and this can lead to energy loss to photons, which then escape so that the stuff cools. So this is the calculation of the capture rate via scattering off mirror nuclei. So you've got standard model nuclei coming in, and they're scattering off mirror nuclei in the star. And here's some expression for the capture rate. Now, this expression is valid only for assuming that the stuff coming in is the same mass as the stuff you're scattering off. But in principle, we have a more general expression. It just looks a bit more horrible. But scattering off different masses. So the cross-section information is in here. So you're basically, it's the rate to scatter down from the velocity that you're at when you fall in to below the escape velocity, which is what this expression is calculating. And this depends on the density of the nuclei in the star, and then some relative velocity of the stuff that's coming in. So this plot is just the capture rate as a function of the mass of the star. So yeah, it's not very interesting, but you can see a bigger star captures more stuff, which makes sense.
What are the capture rate?
Right, so actually, if this isn't what you, to get the total capture rate, you have to multiply this by the density of the interstellar medium. So The total capture rate will depend on how much matter you have just flying around in space. So if you multiply this number by the density of interstellar medium, then you get a capture rate in particles per second, basically.
And is the velocity in there as well for the interstellar medium?
Right, yeah, so this is for...
That's right, it's a fixed velocity, there we go.
Yeah, there I've just taken the relative velocity between the star and the interstellar medium to be like the local velocity dispersion.
What is the average density?
So the average density of the interstellar medium is about it's about a particle per square, per cubic centimeter. So that's about 10 to the 6 GeVs per cubic meter.
So if I were to multiply the same.
Multiply by about 10 to the 6 gives you the average capture rate that you can expect, yeah.
I see, by the entire star.
Okay. So to get from this expression to this, you then have to, because this is a function of R, so you integrate this over R. So you do a volume integral of this.
10 to the 6 variable, so let's say 10 to the 36. And I multiply by 10 to the 18, let's say, for the age of the universe to get how many particles you capture.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is 10 to the 36, 10 to the 52.
Something like that, yeah.
So that means like 10 to the minus 5 solar masses for 10 to the 30 there. So about that.
It's quite a lot. Yeah.
I mean, this is comparable to, like, of course, there's been many studies on, like
Earth.
Yeah, there's
Earth.
Been studies of, like, capture of dark matter in the sun, and this kind of agrees with those kind of studies. Like, you estimate, like, if based on, like, how much dark matter you expect there to be flying around, you can estimate how much dark matter accumulates in the sun.
Do you capture stuff in the Earth? How much do you capture in the Earth?
I guess you capture some.
This is the paper that we're about to put out on direct detection.
Okay.
And it's not enough to affect direct detection. But you capture some. But this is such a much bigger target that's also so much denser and yada yada yada. So.
And this is, you're assuming that the mirror sector is, the stuff that you capture are overall neutral, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So screening, it'll self-neutralize, like.
No, they won't. I mean, if you have, you also have mirror baryon number.
Sure.
So it's not.
Yeah, it's an asymmetric relic. It's just like us. So the important thing to keep in mind for these mirror sectors is that we're not thinking of them as an awesome dark matter candidate necessarily. We're thinking of them as...
No, I'm thinking about...
There's an asymmetric relic, and so they're just left over.
No, what I was thinking more about heating of the Earth and things like that, but if there's no annihilation, how would
heat?
Well, do you get evaporation?
Yes. Well, so actually this plot is the capture rate for helium. Because actually what is showing the next plot is that hydrogen actually evaporates.
It's kind of a naive question, but I mean, if it's really an exact mirror, why is the capture the dominant mechanism? I mean, wherever I had a normal star, it would just be filled with 1/10 as much mirror stuff.
What you mean from the formation, like you expect there just to be some...
Well, gravity, I mean, if I look at the primordial helium abundance and I look at a newly formed star, guess how much helium is inside compared to hydrogen? Why is this different? Why do the lumps of mirror matter, why are they not correlated with the lumps of normal matter?
I guess the clouds...
It's fully mixed to begin with. Why does it get unmixed?
Well, I mean, you wouldn't necessarily expect a big cloud of mirror matter to be corresponding with a cloud of, I guess, gravitationally maybe, but it's like the two sectors don't interact very much.
Like, why? What's the difference between helium and hydrogen?
So, I mean, apart from the fact that if you mix two coffee cups, they end up different, right? Like, these sectors interact to a good approximation only gravitationally, except for that tiny photon mixing. So any small differences between them in terms of their parameters will mean that they cool differently, they collapse differently enough that on the level of stars they are not spatially correlated, like on the level of star size, right? Certainly, maybe there's a mirror disk of mirror stars and it's roughly correlated with ours, but its size will be different because that's given by how efficiently the mirror sector cools as a whole. Like the positions of the stars are going to be, maybe they will reside in our disk, broadly speaking, but they will be totally uncorrelated with our mirror stars within that disk, I would say. So there's no reason for there to be two stars on top of each other, I guess is maybe the point. Although that would be awesome. But I don't see any reason why that would happen.
I mean, the first stars form from the highest peaks in the density distribution, so I don't see why. Yeah, I don't see why gravity wouldn't just do that for you.
No, but you have two completely different disks. Like the disk height is given, like the size of the mirror disk is related to the cooling rate, which is different by an order one factor in the mirror sector because the electron mass is different. So you have different size disks, different thicknesses of disk because the terminal temperature of the disk got drift and dissipate and it's depending on the sort of detailed heat transport within and all that stuff. So I mean, we don't know exactly what the answer is, but we quantify it very carefully to the extent to which we don't know what the answer is. And I mean, once you have sort of two galaxies with same order, but at the order one level, very different morphological quantities on top of each other, I don't see why the mirror stars would coincide. Like why would they spatially coincide? I mean, that would be a rare occurrence, just like binary stars are a rare occurrence, right?
I mean, even if these stars do have some, just from the formation, some standard model matter in there already, I mean, that only just boosts our signal at the end of the day. So this is kind of, you can think of this as an underestimate, I guess, then, if there's other possible ways that matter can get caught inside. I mean, this process certainly happens. And if there's any extra processes, that just helps us in terms of the detectability.
So overall density of the mirror sector is lower by some large factor than the
It doesn't have to be that large. I mean, we're 20% of dark matter. That thing can be
10%.
So maybe it's half as much as we are, or maybe a fifth, or maybe a tenth, but not like it.
And this size, I guess, should be about the same as like our disk size, because it's set by the angular momentum.
It's smaller. This depends on the details of catastrophic collapse during cooling. So when the galaxy forms.
The size of our galaxy is mainly set by the angular momentum.
It is not. That is what we learned we started this. So there's a paper about the galaxy formation. So this is the stellar physics part of it. So there's a paper about the galaxy formation part of the story where we were confidently marching in and being like, aha, we can predict everything we can predict the galaxy structure from the mirror electron mass or something. And we could not have been more wrong, and we were severely humbled by how complicated by how much this depends on the nonlinear magnetohydrodynamics of collapse, because even disk formation, there's conveyor belts of particle transport that get rid of angular momentum and shed it to the halo. There's cooling mechanisms, there's baryonic feedback that changes the rate of cooling and fragmentation. So the upshot is, it is horrifyingly unknowable to be on the order one level of maybe. Like that is literally, I'm happy to go into great detail offline, but this was a very surprising and humbling conclusion.
Also surprised because the
approximate scale of the disk size is given by the radius where the cooling rate equals the dynamical time scale of a characteristic orbit. So wherever those two intersect, if you're inside of that, then you have loss of pressure support, because then the orbits cannot equilibrate the material fast enough to keep up with cooling. Yeah? So that's when the gas cloud starts collapsing. So that is given by the cooling rate as well as the orbital dynamics. That is an incredibly rough order one statement. And at that rough order one level, I can say that if there is a mirror star, if there are mirror disks, if there is a mirror twin Higgs mirror galaxy, its disk size might be somewhat smaller than ours. But it's probably still big enough that we're inside of it, maybe. Right? But beyond that, we've spoken to N-body simulation people for months, and the upshot is just like they throw their hands up in the air when we tell them that you doing this from first principles you simply cannot do beyond order one plausibility arguments. It has been very humbling. Yeah.
Can I just ask, what are the rules? So what are we considering varying? So it's just the Higgs-Bev, or now we're just contemplating all the Yukawa couplings and everything.
I mean, in the mirror twin Higgs model, the minimal thing you do is basically just changing the mirror twin Higgs Vev. Yeah. But like I said, right now, I'm not really considering that specific model anymore. I'm now just thinking about what signal would look like if you had an exact copy of the standard model. So now the only thing you really have to play with is this kinetic mixing between our photon and the mirror photon. So this is the only thing I'm varying. Like, I mean, this is for epsilon 10 to the minus 9. But yeah, that's a free parameter, essentially. The only free parameter as far as this stuff is concerned. Yeah. Right, yeah, so that's the capture rate. You can also have self-capture. Now, of course, once the amount of captured material exceeds sort of like epsilon squared times the density of the mirror nuclei, incoming matter is actually more likely to scatter off the already captured matter than it is the mirror matter. And once you get to that point, the capture rate sort of grows exponentially because the capture rate is proportional to the amount that you've captured. And so it just accumulates and accumulates until you reach this sort of geometric limit, which essentially is the statement that the capture cross-section of this object can't be more than like the physical sort of size of the star. Like if it captures everything that goes through it, the capture rate can't exceed some sort of geometric sort of limit. And so here I've plotted the mirror capture rate that comes from the previous slide. Then you have the sort of geometric capture rate from like just taking the capture target as something of the size of the star, or you may have that the captured matter is accumulating maybe with some fractional size of the total star, and then your capture rate is a bit less. But the point is that even if the entire star is a capture target, this is the mirror capture is already bigger than that, so it's extremely efficient at capturing material. And it's already, and this capture rate exceeds the geometric limit, so really you should be using the geometric limit to think about how much stuff you're capturing, even if it's just scattering off mirror nuclei. So there was a more complicated expression for the geometric capture rate, because it also kind of depends on, it's not just stuff flying through like a circular target, it's also stuff which gets gravitationally pulled in, so it depends on the sort of relative velocity as well, but that's what I've plotted here. And then evaporation. So here I've just plotted for the sun, the escape velocity is a function of R. And then you sort of have the thermal velocity of the captured stuff, assuming it was thermalized with the stuff in the star, which it may not be. But in this case, the thermal velocity isn't so far below the escape velocity. And so like there is some tail of the Boltzmann distribution which has an escape velocity which is higher than the escape velocity of the star, and so some fraction of the stuff will just, like, you can think of it about it collides with something in the star, it gets a kick which gives it a velocity greater than the escape velocity, and it just flies out. And because there's like a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution in here somewhere, the evaporation probability, there's like an exponential of the mass of the captured particle. So it really depends very sensitively on the mass of the stuff that you're capturing. And people have done these kind of calculations for the sun, thinking about, okay, let's say we have some dark matter particle of mass m being captured in the sun. And for the sun, there's like some critical mass below which evaporation is important, and above which is completely negligible. By negligible, I mean evaporation rate. It's negligible once like solar lifetimes. So from this, we see that for the sun, hydrogen is well below this critical mass. So hydrogen actually very efficiently evaporates. You can calculate the evaporation rate compared to the capture rate, and you see that not very much accumulates at all. But for helium is above this critical mass, which means that evaporation never matters for helium capture of the lifetime of the sun. And for bigger stars, hydrogen still evaporates pretty efficiently, but and then helium just gets further away from this. This limit goes down slightly for more massive stars. So the takeaway from this slide is that actually most of the material that accumulates in the star is helium rather than hydrogen.
So if there were no cooling, then I'd expect that thermal velocity is of the order.
Right. Yeah.
But there is really no cooling, so I'm surprised that it's less efficient than that.
You mean that once it's cooled, it's less likely to evaporate? Is that? Yeah. But, I mean, even yeah. But if you imagine like hydrogen, for example, is captured and then cools, it's still like every time it collides with the mirror nucleus, it's going to get some kick. Like it will collide with mirror nuclei fairly rarely, but when you capture, this evaporation rate is actually sort of, you can calculate it just by taking into account the collisions with the mirror nuclei. And so every time a hydrogen atom gets a kick from a hydrogen nuclei in the mirror hydrogen nuclei in the star, there's still some probability, regardless of what the temperature that it's cooled down to, that it's going to get a kick from that collision, which is going to kick it out of the star, essentially.
Right. There is also emission, right? Because the temperature, that velocity is very high. So there is radiative emission. So why doesn't it collide the kinetic energy that it has, then it gets excited, and then there is Lyman alpha cooling, for example. Or ionization, for that matter, which would make it even...
So wait, are you saying that I have my completely cold standard model hydrogen sit just hanging out in the center of the star or whatever. And then the hot it's mirror hybrid.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, by the way, the other thing is the cross section of standard model hitting each other because stars get accumulating in the star and it's very dense.
Mm-hmm.
So stars hitting each other, so the cross section with that is very efficient. So you start hitting each other and then poof, because the temperature is very. It's the usual. Yeah. It's the usual story. Why gas cools in galaxies?
Hang on, sorry, so what's the statement here? Because all this is saying is that disregard the rest of the standard model matter. You just have a single standard model hydrogen and you have the hot mirror star that has temperature T, and it will occasionally supply a collision that is so far on the
open
tail that it will kick it right out.
But that
doesn't affect the collisions of the arbitrarily cold standard model hydrogen with the hot mirror helium.
Right, but if I'm hitting a cold hydrogen atom much more often than I'm hitting a hot mirror atom.
You're saying it could the evaporation rate could be overestimated because we're assuming it's free streaming.
Exactly. You're
assuming it's free streaming, right.
Which is not a good approximation.
So evaporation rate versus cooling rate is
exactly,
the important number.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah, we'll
right. Yeah, I mean, I guess so. Before you reach the point where there's a lot of captured standard model matter, this is valid. So the initial stuff that accumulates will be helium, but then maybe once you get a lot of helium accumulating, then you can start to capture hydrogen efficiently, possibly. Mm. So maybe that's something we're underestimating.
Mm.
But again, it's an underestimate. This would just mean that we capture more stuff.
Mm. No, but that's a good
but that's
point.
That's fair. Yeah.
It's very nice, actually.
So, I mean, most of the calculations from here on in that I've done are for helium, but they can be done for if there's some fraction of captured hydrogen as well, that you can do the similar calculations. But yeah. So we kind of have a sort of a handle on how much matter we'll capture now. So now we care about thinking about what the matter will look like once it's captured. So we want to think about how do we think about this? Well, let's assume, first of all, that the captured matter is in some kind of hydrostatic equilibrium. We're going to assume for now that it's isothermal and then try and justify that later. Now, so hydrostatic equilibrium, we're normally balancing pressure, the pressure of the gas with the gravitational pull to collapse it. But this stuff also feels a kind of like a weird external pressure just from collisions with the mirror matter. So
you still equate interaction with matter with matter.
Right, so when I write down this equation here for this hydrostatic equilibrium, this is the pressure term from captured matter colliding with captured matter. This is just the normal pressure of the captured matter gas. Here I have some pressure coming from collisions with the mirror matter. And then I have the gravitational. And so I'm just putting in the sort of mass function of the mirror star as the gravitational well that it's sitting in.
Mm-hmm.
And so the punchline of this is going to be that because I have these two different pressure sources, I'm going to get sort of two distinct profiles that get set up.
Cooling, though. So for the temperature, you're still not taking cooling into account, the fact that helium can collide with helium, especially.
So I'm going to talk about heating and cooling later on. For now, this is just saying, well, let's assume that the captured matter is at some temperature T.
And this is what happens.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah. So we want to look for solutions to this equation. There's just some fun maths here because like I stared at this equation for a while and was like, okay, given I have these functions of R, which like I get from these profiles, I have the pressure profile, the mass profile. Can I look for a solution to this? And then found out that there's something that I learned in like first year undergrad, something called integrating factors, which is, if you're like me, is something that you learned and then never ever used. But like this is kind of nice because you can just write down the solution to this as this thing here. So you have these two terms. So if you set B to zero, that corresponds to setting this external mirror pressure to zero, and then you just get the self-supporting solution that you'd normally expect from like a gas that collapses. So that's this term here. And so you have this constant of integration here, which is basically like you throw more matter in, this constant of integration grows, so you have some sort of profile which gets taller when you add more matter. Makes sense. Then you have this weird term out here, which is like doesn't have any constants of integration here. This is just some profile that you just have. Doesn't seem to depend on how much matter is there, which is a bit strange. so I want to understand this term a bit better. It turns out in this limit where this integral here, which is a function of R, a dimensionless number, when this is more than one, you can actually You mean if you play around with this long enough, you can convince yourself that this thing here is well approximated by B of R over A of R. And the nice thing about this is that you can see this is just the solution of this equation if you set this first term to zero, which is basically saying when you're neglecting the pressure, the self-pressure that it feels, then this is the solution for the density profile that you get. So this kind of looks like this. So this is as a function of R, you have this sort of, and the weird thing is the height of this is just completely fixed by the sort of profile of the star. So the interpretation of this is that this is the amount of matter that the mirror pressure can support. And since the mirror pressure is just some number as a function of R, there is some fixed amount of material that this pressure can support. If you throw more matter in, it just falls to the core and accumulates. So if you throw more stuff in, you have this core profile here, and then you have this sort of puffier region, which extends further out. and it turns out the amount of matter you need to throw in to satisfy this profile is, it accumulates extremely quickly. So like, you know, over a few years or something, because this density is not that high. And then the inner solution you get will depend, like the size of the core that you form will depend on the temperature. If it's a higher temperature, it's sort of puffier. If it's colder, it collapses. And you can estimate this sort of characteristic radius from the variable theorem, and then you can compare that to the numerical solution. This works. So you basically have some profile here, the size of which depends on the temperature. And you might think we just don't care about this region at all, since the densities here are a lot lower than the density that you're going to get in the core. But actually, what we care about is like the density. For a lot of the calculations, we care about the density of like ions and free electrons. And so it's not clear that you can just neglect this region. Like actually, a lot of the ionized fraction in this region can actually be a lot higher than the ionized fraction in the core. So it's worth considering both these profiles. Yep. So okay, now we want to know what the temperatures are. One, because you want to know the ionized fraction, and two, because you want to know the size of this sort of inner core region here, where the stuff is accumulating.
And the interesting point is the puffy region profile does not depend on the mirror temperature. It only depends on the star completely. So it's a very robust feature, independent of the mirror, of the standard model temperature.
I should say
some suspended cloud.
It doesn't depend on the temperature of the standard model as long as the temperature is for low mass stars, and if the temperature of the material in this was actually in thermal equilibrium with the star, then it would matter.
This is the thing, you're making the assumption that there's no cooling. So the temperature...
Oh, that's going to come back.
No, even if this stuff cools, this profile is independent of temperature. This, it's...
If it's zero temperature, you're saying that it's atmosphere...
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of doesn't make sense to talk about zero temperature because it's still being... It's supported by...
He's very, very small. Yeah, he's taking some extremely...
Yeah, I mean, what's happening is it's the collisions with the mirror nuclei which are supporting this. So the same collisions which are supporting it are also going to heat it. Yeah.
No, but I was thinking of the opposite thing, where the temperature becomes too high. I mean, there cooling... Well, then maybe cooling is more important because the interactions between standard model and standard model particles...
I mean this is just in thermal equilibrium with the star. So this is just a part of the star. It's a little cloud.
No, but I'm talking about with itself, right? There are two processes. You're fighting against something that's epsilon square suppressed,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and something that the density of so actually it's comparable, because if I were to multiply the density, the density of stars is the similar like matter density, right? This is about 10 to the 30
right. particles yeah, this density
per
is,
meter cubed.
It's about epsilon squared times the density of the
exactly.
star. That's
so
not a coincidence.
The two effects seem to be comparable. In fact, for the case that you have there, for epsilon, you get much higher density. So if I were to multiply by epsilon squared, in the case in the left,
mm-hmm.
the epsilon squared times n of the star is less than the density that you're plotting there. Because the epsilon squared times the density of the star is like, the density of the star is about 10 to the 30 protons per meter cubed.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Epsilon squared.
Well, epsilon squared is 10 to the minus 18. It's pretty much the same. I mean.
Yeah, that's true. Well, but close to that peak, then it starts getting.
Sure, sure.
I mean, it's high, right? So.
Right, but even like. I mean, the point is this: the shape of this profile does not depend on the temperature, as long as it's below some. As long as it's not too high, you can show that this shape doesn't depend on the temperature. So then I just take this density as an input, calculate what the heating is as a function of this density, calculate what the cooling would be.
Yeah.
And to find sort of what the temperature of this region. So that's what I talk about next. I mean, I talk about the heating and cooling rates. So. Which, oh, this thing here, you mean? Huh. Yeah, I think that's.
So then that's not taking into account the accumulated stuff that is not MERS star supported.
Right, so on top of this profile, you also want to plot this one as well, which I haven't plotted just because it's narrower, so.
Oh, it's just part of the density, okay.
Yeah, so then you have like a core which like shoots up, like the density of the core is like way higher, so at some point this you have to add on top of this the profile of the core, so this will go up towards the core. Yeah. But this shape remains, as you throw more stuff in, this shape remains roughly constant, and then the core just gets denser and denser and denser, basically. So yeah, we've talked about heating, so there's some general cross-section for the heating, like collisions between the mirror nuclei and the captured stuff. You have to worry a bit about whether the captured stuff is atomic or ionized, because if it cools below a certain temperature, it's going to be atomic, and the cross-section gets screened. There's just like a sort of, it's what it would be for hydrogen, but there's some electron screening of this scattering. But you can plug this in, you know, you can estimate the heating power, it's proportional to the density of the captured stuff, the density of the mirror nuclei, there's a cross-section, and then there's some sort of characteristic energy transfer that's happening. And then you have to think about cooling. So there's various processes by which the stuff can cool. This is the expression for the power output due to Bremsstrahlung, assuming that it's optically thin. So this depends on the density of ions and the density of electrons, and it depends on the temperature. So this is just purely interactions between the captured standard model stuff. So it's not, there's no epsilon squared suppression in this term. Of course, these sorts of processes also contribute to the signal in the standard model. So I talked about this conversion signal of direct conversion via Thomson scattering. It's a completely different process to this. This is coming from like the gas itself is being heated and cooling, and this produces, there's going to be some characteristic luminosity coming out due to these processes. So to do this properly, you have to estimate the ionized fraction of the captured material, and this is also a function of temperature. For a while, I thought maybe you use Sahar's equation for this, but it turns out that when the material is optically thin, you don't use Sahar's equation. You write the ionized fraction as a sort of a ratio of the ionization cross sections and the recombination cross section. And for this is just for helium, and you can see this is for helium, I think. And the point is that the cooling always depends, in some sense, on how much ionization you have. So once you get below a certain temperature, sort of order 1,000 Kelvin, the cooling just completely drops to zero because you've got a gas of atoms and there's no way that it can cool anymore. And so, yes, the cooling is not suppressed by epsilon, but the heating is suppressed by epsilon. But at the end of the day, you end up with a gas which is sort of around sort of 4,000 to 6,000 Kelvin is the numbers that I get out of the that's for the core, sorry. For the outer region, it can be a bit higher.
But bottom line, it's not ionized much.
Right. The inner region, especially the core region, is not ionized. There's quite a small ionization fraction, but also the density is really high. So even though you have a small ionization fraction, the overall density of free electrons is still pretty high. And this is just to say, I solve for the sort of the temperature of the outer region and the inner region. Some sort of number. These don't vary that much as a function of the mass of the star, interestingly. I guess because the temperature doesn't vary hugely over sort of these the star mass ranges. Okay. So we have a sort of.
Jack, I have to run. Oh. I have a meeting at 2. So.
Ah, I'm overrunning. Oh, okay.
it's not your fault. It's our
okay.
fault. Okay. Okay. Sorry.
Right. So you get sort of temperatures around 6,000 Kelvin for the inner region, 12,000 for the outer region. At these temperatures and densities, we checked that the gas is actually optically thin, which justifies the assumptions that we made about the ionization fraction. So now that we sort of understand what the captured matter looks like, the temperature and density profiles, we can start to estimate the signal. So we have this conversion signal that I talked about earlier, which is just this depends on the density of essentially free electrons in the gas, which so you can have this conversion process. In principle, you can have conversion from other processes as well, because, okay, you can imagine an atom might absorb a mirror photon and emit a standard model photon. So all the things which can contribute to the star's opacity can also contribute to this conversion process. But for now, we're just taking into account this Thomson scattering of free electrons process, which simplifies things because this is frequency independent. It doesn't depend on the frequency of the photon. And the cross-section is just given here. And then for a given frequency, you can estimate the intensity at that frequency from this conversion process. So gamma here is like the rate of this process. And then you do some integral over the star. And because this gas is really optically thin, you really are probing the whole profile of the star. This integral runs from 0 to r. At each value of r, you can estimate the energy density of photons as a function of the temperature. And so you get this integral over the temperature, essentially. You're sampling the temperature all the way through the star. And so the average temperature of a star is around sort of x-rays, so the signal is basically into x-rays. okay, and we also have this cooling signal. And if you know the heating rate and cooling rate, you can estimate how much standard model photons are lost via cooling. So it's just given by this. You can estimate just from the heating, like how much energy is transferred from the core of the star into the matter. And because the core is at a temperature of around 6,000 Kelvin, this is essentially a visible light signal. This is in the visible range. It's not that different from the effective temperature of the sun. So it looks like we have this sort of dual signature. We have an X-ray signature coming from this conversion, and we also have a visible light signal coming from the sort of heating and cooling of the core. So now I'm just going to show a few plots of what this looks like based on all the calculations that, you know, I run this for some benchmark stars and then plot. In blue, I have this sort of conversion luminosity into X-rays, and in yellow, the cooling luminosity. So it looks like the luminosity that you get into visible light coming from this heating and cooling is generally a lot higher than the X-ray luminosity. I mean, this is plotted as a fraction of the luminosity of the sun. So here it's like sort of like 10 to the minus 8 times the luminosity of the sun could potentially be emitted by these things into visible light. And you have a much smaller fraction of X-rays, but still potentially this is a visible signal. Detectable signal, this is visible. here's just to show how this varies with epsilon. You would predict that this would grow with epsilon, but it kind of falls off quite rapidly for smaller values of epsilon. And the reason being that you make epsilon smaller, then you're massively suppressing the heating, and then the core just collapses. And if the core is smaller, you get much less of a signal. It's because like there's some sense it depends on the volume of this stuff, and then it cools, there's ionization fraction is also lower, so there's lots of things which kill your signal for smaller values of epsilon. It also depends on the amount of matter that you've captured. So for now, I've just assumed to take an average value for the density of the interstellar medium. But in principle, you can imagine a star might be in some very, very dense part of the galaxy and accumulates a lot more than on average. The cooling luminosity goes up a lot if you capture more material, but this sort of conversion signal into X-ray doesn't rise quite as steeply. Just as a benchmark, sort of around here is where you'd expect for like an average star, sort of solar mass star absorbing like the average amount of interstellar density. So could we see these things? So the signal is pretty faint, so we're thinking about looking for objects which are nearby. I mean, obviously, the ones we'd see are the ones which are closest to us. So just as a benchmark, let's take a solar mass mirror star with an epsilon 10 to the minus 9 at a distance of 1 light-year. The X-ray signal you get, the instant flux at the Earth, is sort of 3 times 10 to the minus 18 ergs per centimeter squared per second. Now, this is pretty small. I think by comparison that the faintest X-ray sources we know are about the same. So we have seen things which are as bright as this, but this is because we're kind of, with our X-ray telescopes, you have to stare at these regions for a long time in order to get this sort of sensitivity. So this plot is showing these two are like existing X-ray telescopes. Athena is planned for the future, and this one in red, which you can't really see, is a proposed X-ray telescope in the future. And you can see that on this axis, you've plotted the area of the sky that you're looking at. So if you focus in on a smaller size, angular size of the sky, you stare for longer, and you can get a greater sensitivity. So this sensitivity, this flux here is sort of sitting around here. So with this, you know, futuristic telescope, and you could rule out mirror stars within 1 light-year. You could rule out this kind of mirror star within 1 light-year for within this is essentially 1/1000th of the sky, so that's not very good. But if you had a bigger star at 1 light-year, you can get like 1,000 times greater flux.
So how would you know it's a smaller star, not something else?
Right, I mean, I'll talk about that in a second, because you essentially have this dual signal. You do have this X-ray signal, which, okay, admittedly is pretty faint, but we also have this light signature, which, as I sort of showed, can be a lot higher than the X-ray signature. So at 10 light years, our one solar mass benchmark mirror star actually has the same apparent magnitude of some moon of Jupiter, which was discovered in 2000, a magnitude of 21. At 100 light years, the same star would have an apparent magnitude of Fenrir, which is a moon of Saturn, which is about 25. For comparison, Gaia aims to catalog all stars which have an apparent magnitude of 20 or brighter. So it's not so unrealistic that we haven't really looked into the details of like what the real limits are on how bright an object could be, and yet still not discovered. Hubble can do way better.
If you stay long enough, you'll see it. Yeah.
Right, like the Hubble Deep Field has like magnitudes of like 35 or something, yeah, which is like many orders of magnitude dimmer.
Right.
But the problem is that, you know, we don't know where these mirror stars are, so we can't just pick a point of the sky, stare at it, and hope to see it.
Don't we know like roughly like the density of it in our galaxy?
Well, we're looking to see one within 1 to 10 light years. A number of stars within 1 to 10 light years is not very many. There's like order 10, 20 stars within 10 light years or something like that. So you'd expect there not maybe to be a few mirror stars. I mean, it depends, of course, on how they form and all these details about the disk that we were talking about before, but...
I mean, at the end of the day, the point is that this is, if you were to see this, it's crazy. It's X-rays, invisible light, in a way that makes no sense for a sort of standard astrophysical object.
Yeah. Right.
Also, what is the spectrum?
Well, if you have an X-ray signal and you have a visible light signature, like the ratio of the X-ray signature to the visible light signature, like the ratio of those luminosities, ought to be way higher than it is for a normal star. So if you take the sun, and like the sun does emit some X-rays, but if you look at the sort of fractional luminosity in X-rays compared to visible light of the sun, it's really, really tiny. But these things, you're getting this direct conversion signal from the core. Like this conversion stuff, which is happening, photons converting to standard model photons, you see them from the core, you see these X-rays. And so this is a process that you would never get in a normal star. So you'd never get to see that much.
What about AGNs? Because you can get visible light and X-rays from AGNs.
Right, but then these things have parallax because we're seeing them closer. You've got an object within 10 light years, you look at it at different times of the year, it's going to be a slightly different place. AGNs obviously don't have that. So it has this sort of weird signal, which are small, very hot object that's emitting X-rays. It has no right to be as hot as it is, but it's nearby, but it's also very dim, so it can't be a normal star. Like, I think if you did see something like this, there's enough weirdness about it. Like, there's nothing that could be that close and that small that could give this signature. Yeah, I mean, we still need to understand a bit better whether we can actually put any bounds based on like current observations in the visible light. But it certainly seems like Gaia could at least put some bounds on this. You know, it could say that you couldn't see, if it's seeing everything greater than magnitude 10, then for some benchmark model, at least, you could say there's nothing like this within maybe 5 light years, 1 light year, or whatever it turns out to be. Anyway, I'll conclude there. So I'll say again, mirror stars are theoretically well-motivated. There are some well-motivated models that predict mirror sectors, rather. And if there's mirror sectors, then maybe there can be mirror stars. I've explained that these things can efficiently capture interstellar matter, and this matter enables this photon conversion into X-ray. We also have the heating and cooling of the captured matter produces this visible signal. And it's a weird signal. It's a nearby, hot, small, faint object with parallax that has a X-ray signature which is higher than it ought to be for like a brown dwarf or a star or something like that. And so it would be a weird signal, and if we saw it, it'd be great. But yeah, I'll finish there. Thanks.
Thanks. Other questions?
One more thing about the X-ray, so most point sources are parallax. So if you would predict that it's not, then that would be easier to identify, even if you don't take into account visibility.
Power law, as in?
Power law and energy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the spectrum is certainly something you can predict. If you understand the temperature profile of the mirror star, then you can predict the spectrum. If you understand the the temperature profile of the mirror star and the profiles of the captured stuff, then you can actually make a prediction for the spectrum of X-rays. I mean, I don't know how, for something that faint, how much you can actually measure the spectrum, but if you can measure the spectrum, then it can fit, you can fit it to some mirror star model. And
yeah, is there a, how well, is there an easy way to understand the sort of spectral shape precision you'd get for very, very faint X-ray sources, or? I guess it's sort of.
So an X-ray, one photon needs detection, two photon needs spectrum.
Cool. Okay, so you assume however many photons you see, you make a statistical plot at the end.
Right.
Okay, great. Good. We can do that. Good.
So your signature would be a cross-correlation of like a star catalog of Gaia with unidentified X-ray sources, or you would look for the X-ray source and then, I mean, what would be the...
I guess the first thing you do is, I mean, I guess if Gaia really saw something that was that close and that faint, that would be weird already, I suppose. And if you were... Then you could stare at it for a long time with an X-ray telescope and see if it's emitting any X-rays.
Yeah.
And then compare the luminosity into X-rays that you get with the visible luminosity and boom. Like.
The other way around, if X-ray surveys find a point source and it has parallax and it has a faint optical signal, like, we don't know yet what the sort of best... We're still, as particle theorists, our understanding of sort of these astrophysical surveys is evolving. So,
yeah.
So, yeah. But it seems discoverable. Yeah. That's the point.
Yeah. Are there other questions? Or, well, then I think we can thank again, Jack.